Double happy hour.
Absolutely. It's time for the Friday edition of American Hit Radio, WHPC 90.3 FM, Garden City, New York. Tom Ryan here, Heidi Morales. Ryan, right over there, right next to me.
Always with you.
As we bring you the Friday edition, which we call How Music Changed, where we look at some of the most important and influential artists in the history of recorded music. We started a brand new series just last week.
It's all shiny.
Yeah, it's all shiny new. For us, it is, anyway. And so we're going to basically, we'll continue, of course, along this route with a second show on this artist. We're looking at Mr. Eric Clapton. And last week, we spent a good deal of the first part of the show really just talking about his early life, and then covered some demo material that he had recorded with the Yardbirds, and then the first two singles, the A-sides and the B-sides. His time with the Yardbirds was very short-lived.
He poquito.
Really wasn't long with the band for a very long time. One album, and what's weird is that one album never really got released properly in America. It was called Five Live Yardbirds. Incredibly influential record in the terms of this, the fact that, first of all, it's the first album that Eric Clapton is appearing on.
Right.
He makes a huge impact on the record-buying public in Great Britain to the point where they are now like emulating. Clapton is God graffiti is beginning to appear and weird stuff like that, you know? And he is, I mean, obviously probably a bit freaked out about it. Probably he'll talk about it a little bit. We're going to read excerpts from his book. But while this is going on, he's uncomfortable with the Yardbirds because he's such a purist. He's got, you know, he's a young idealist at this point in time.
That's what people did over there. Like, they just wanted to be as pure as they could, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And he was the ultimate example of that.
Or folkies here in this country, too.
Yes, like American, the American folk scene, there's very, right, there was a tremendous purist streak in that. That's where Clapton was coming from with this, is he wanted to play the blues. He didn't want to see it get tampered with or messed with.
Watered down.
Which even he said was kind of funny in a sense, because they were English guys desperately wanting to play the blues, but they were anything but purists by definition.
Right.
It kind of made no sense. There were so many things about that, about England, that was going on in terms of like various scenes. Like the trad jazz scene had a big streak of that in it.
Yes.
It's an English trait. And Clapton
bless
had it.
Them.
Right. Clapton had it very full on. So anyway, the one album is out. I said that in Great Britain, it did not really get released in America in its proper form, called Five Live Yardbirds. It's also weird that the album never even appeared, or excerpts from that album never even appeared on the box set Crossroads, which I think is a bit
nutty. That is weird.
Considering how important it is. So let's correct that wrong right now by playing one of the more obviously influential tracks from that album, prominently featuring Eric Clapton on lead guitar. And from the album Five Live Yardbirds, here is that very band performing their version of I'm a Man.
Amsterdam to Kansas too. Gotta get me a motel. I got a count room. I'm a man. May 21. You know, baby. Well, I'm fine. I'm a man. Spell M.
I.
Muddy Waters song, of course, as performed by the Yardbirds. Now, they play it, you know, much too fast, and they do a couple things. Like, I mean, when Muddy did it, the whole point was to basically never leave that root chord
right,
to build up the tension. And they absolutely do, because it's very hard to not...
Because they're amateurs.
Yeah, right. They're, you know, young. When you, I think I blamed it on being young, you know, like restless. So you can't stand that chord. You got to change it. You know, you got to do something. But the one thing they got right is they kept some of the humor in there, because you know that Muddy Waters definitely did not intend that to be a dead serious song.
Right.
And they got that right, which is pretty cool.
Well, good for them.
Now I'm going to be reading throughout the show, as I will be throughout this whole series, from Clapton's autobiography, which is rather ingeniously called Clapton. And it'll basically help to mark his frame of mind as we move our way through the history of it. Here's his take on this period. While most other bands were playing three-minute songs, we were taking three-minute numbers and stretching them out to 5 or 6 minutes, during which time the audience would go crazy, shaking their heads around manically and dancing in various outlandish ways. On my guitar, I used light-gauge guitar strings with a very thin first string, which made it easier to bend the notes, and it was not uncommon during the most frenetic bits of playing for me to break at least one string. During the pause while I was changing my string, the frenzied audience would often break into a slow hand clap, inspiring Giorgio to dream up the nickname of Slow Hand Clapton. Now I'll play one more track from the album Five Live Yardbirds. I want you to listen to this and tell me if it basically reminds you of anything else that you might have heard. It depends on how much you know your rock and roll history, especially your British invasion rock and roll history. The name of this track is Got Love If You Want It.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming out. Cool. I got love if you want it, baby. I'm
get it yet?
No.
No.
Well, it's funny when you think about the history of music in Great Britain. I mean, when you hear everybody tell the story, the Rolling Stones tell it, Eric Clapton tells a story about when they started playing the blues, they'd be playing in clubs and there'd be like two or three people. The only other people that were there were the other people that were going to be playing that night.
Right.
Waiting to get up. It was like such a...
Some things never change.
Yeah, very rarefied. And, right. And they were completely... It was outsider music by far. And yet it turns out that by 1964, everybody wanted to play the blues. It became as huge as the Merseybeat thing that the Beatles had. And that's why a lot of these bands became hugely famous, like the Rolling Stones. Like, for example, that track we just heard is called Got Love If You Want It. Well, when the Rolling Stones released their first live album, they used a pun of that title for their live album. They called it Got Live If You Want It.
Oh, that's funny.
You know, nobody in America got it. It's like, no. That's a goofy name for a live album. Why is it called Got Live If You Want It? It doesn't even make sense. But if you knew this song, you'd get that it was a pun.
Right.
And it was, you know, basically the Rolling Stones playing off of this track by the Yardbirds, which they had popularized, and it shows you how many people were really listening to it. For example, there was another band that was just recording around this time. They released their very first single right after this came out, and it's almost hysterical to hear it now because it's the exact same song with different words. The name of this group is The High Numbers. See if it makes any sense as you listen to this track.
If you wanna do, all the others are third class tickets by me, baby. Is that clear?
It's not a rewrite, it's flat out plagiarism, right?
Yeah.
Now, I didn't really even know it because I didn't know the original song by the Yardbirds off of the album Five Live Yardbirds because it wasn't released in America. So
it's
one of this revisionist history things like, oh, look at that. It's amazing. Well, you know who that was?
Who was that?
That was The Who.
Oh, that's hysterical.
That's The Who. That was Roger Daltrey singing, Pete Townsend.
That was really early Who, huh?
They called themselves, that was their very first single. They put it out as The High Numbers. They didn't call themselves The Who yet. So there you go. Anyway, getting back to Eric Clapton's notes here of around this time. Though the Yardbirds weren't yet in the big money league, we were making enough for me to buy my first really serious guitar, a cherry red Gibson ES-335, the instrument of my dreams, of which the K had been but a poor imitation. Throughout my life, I chose a lot of my guitars because of the other people who played them, and this was like the one Freddie King played. It was the first of a new era of guitars, which were thin and semi-acoustic. There were both a rock guitar and a blues guitar, which you could play, if necessary, without amplification and still hear them. I had seen the Gibson in a shop on either Charing Cross Road or Denmark Street, where several music stores had electric guitars in the windows. To me, they were just like sweet shops. I would stand outside staring at these things for hours on end, especially at night when the windows would remain lit up, and after a trip to the marquee, I would walk around all night looking and dreaming. When I finally bought the Gibson, I just couldn't believe how shiny and beautiful it was. At last, I felt like a real musician. The truth is, I was taking myself far too seriously and becoming very critical and judgmental of anybody in music who wasn't playing just pure blues. This attitude was probably part of my intellectual phase. I was reading translations of Baudelaire and discovering the American underground writers like Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg while simultaneously watching as much French and Japanese cinema as I could. I began to develop a real contempt for pop music in general and to feel genuinely uncomfortable about being in the Yardbirds. No longer were we going in the direction I wanted, mainly because, seeing the runaway success of the Beatles, Giorgio and some of the guys had become obsessed with getting on TV and having a number one record. It's quite possible that Giorgio was still smarting from having lost the Stones, but what was clear was that we weren't moving upward fast enough, so each of us was told to go out there and find a hit song. Actually, I had no problem with having a hit, as long as it was a song we could be proud of. Funny enough, Giorgio had played me a song by Otis Redding called Your One and Only Man several months before. It was a catchy song, which I felt we could do a version of without selling ourselves short. Then, Paul Samuel Smith came up with a song called For Your Love by Graham Goldman, later of 10cc, which was clearly a number one. I balked, but the others all loved it, and that was that. When the Yardbirds decided to record For Your Love, I knew it was the beginning of the end for me, as I didn't see how we could make a record like that and stay as we were. It felt to me that we had completely sold out. I played on it, though my contribution was limited to a very short blues riff in the middle eight section, and as a consolation, they gave me the B-side, an instrumental called Got to Hurry, which was based on a tune hummed by Giorgio, who gave himself the writing credit under the pseudonym O. Rasputin. Here's that A-side, and if we can, we'll play the B-side too. The A-side's For Your Love.
Days that will excite and make you dream of me at night. We'll be right back.
And this is the part of the story that's hard for me to understand, Eric Clapton, in a sense, because, I mean, here you've got the A side, For Your Love.
Right.
Obviously, an excellent pop hit.
Right.
That wasn't just a huge hit in England, but it became a big pop hit in America. It
was absolutely
part of the British invasion. A huge, huge hit. And Eric Clapton made so much noise about it that the band even conceded by saying, okay, we'll give you the B-side all to yourself.
Right.
And he gets to play this instrumental blues called Got to Hurry, and they put it on the B-side. He's a star performer in a group that's totally primed for the big time. It's obvious now that they had just finally achieved exactly what they were going for. And anybody else would say, okay, I'm in this band, so I'm just going to steer it in the direction that I want to. So this is my means of being able to do what I want to do. It's his first band. He's barely, you know, he's not even in it for a full year at this point in time. And yet he quits. Just quits. I mean, it's so hard to, I mean, was that crazy or is that like misguided conviction?
You know, probably at this time in history, all these young guys, they think, well, I did it once, I'll do it again, you know?
Yeah, and he was right to think that. But it takes a tremendous amount of confidence in yourself.
Well, I don't know that that would be true in this day and age.
Yeah, I don't know either. But, well, as he puts it, this is Clapton's words about it. By then, I was a pretty grizzled and discontented individual. I deliberately made myself as unpopular as I could by being constantly argumentative and dogmatic about everything that came up. Eventually, Giorgio just called me to his office in Soho and told me that it was quite clear that I was no longer happy in the band, and that if I wanted to leave, then he wouldn't stand in my way. He didn't exactly fire me. He just invited me to resign. Totally disillusioned, I was at that point ready to quit the music business altogether. Initially, I was distraught after leaving the Yardbirds. I felt much as I did when I was thrown out of art school and the reality finally kicked in. But in a short time, my equilibrium came back and I was able to pat myself on the back for sticking to my principles, even though I wasn't really sure quite what my principles were. For Your Love was a huge hit, and nobody on the outside could understand why I had chosen such a moment to quit when the band was on the up. But the truth is, I felt it was a dreadful waste of what had potentially been a good rock blues band. For a time, I returned to live in Ripley, feeling shy, frightened, and disheartened by a business in which everyone seemed to be on the make and selling out rather than being in it for the music. For a while, I stayed with Rose and Jack, who were both very supportive of me, the step-parents. By then, I think they knew I was serious about what I was doing and had decided to stand behind me. In the meantime, a friend had given another friend the phone number to John Mayall, a blues musician with a credible reputation and leader of his own band, the Bluesbreakers. He called and asked if I might be interested in joining his outfit. I knew who he was from the Marquee, and I admired him because he was then doing exactly what I always thought we could have done with the Yardbirds. He had found his niche and was staying there, touring good clubs and making the odd record without ever really going for broke. Clapton showed up, this is me talking now, and made a few recordings with John Mayall. Actually, they'd made a couple of two-piece recordings that actually was released as an A-side and a B-side. So this is what Clapton basically was releasing after he left the Yardbirds. His next recorded piece of work was this odd two-man single with John Mayall on vocals and piano and Eric Clapton accompanying him on guitar. The A-side was called Lonely Years.
Thank you.
No doubt, Clapton had found a purer version of the blues.
Yes,
by
definitely.
Doing that.
I mean, it's something to be admired there, anyway. He's following the conviction of his heart.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you can never fault somebody for following what they really believe in, and Clapton was doing that here. Of course, from a commercial perspective,
it's
a completely different thing when you go from that to this. And what's not mentioned in the book is that this was almost a year had passed of total silence from the time that he left the Yardbirds in, say, it was like late 1964, when the British invasion was going strong and the Yardbirds continued to ride high. And Clapton did pretty much nothing for most of 1965. This was recorded very late in the year 1965. So the year that was the pretty much the pinnacle of the British invasion saw Eric Clapton as having no part in it whatsoever, just vanishing.
He retired.
And recording this track. As I said, a rather obscure single. Oddly enough, he included the B-side on the collection Crossroads as well. So let's hear that too. This track is called Bernard Jenkins. It's the B-side of that same single.
Thank you.
Other than the fact that it's Eric Clapton on the guitar, there's really nothing at all about that song that is particularly stunning. I mean, it's the reason it's probably included in the box set Crossroads is it marks the very first time that a song was credited as being written by Eric Clapton.
Ah.
You know, despite the fact
he's
that it's
demonstrating his technical abilities.
But that's really it. I mean, it's an ordinary 12-bar shuffle.
It is. Well, that's what he's maybe based a career on, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, back to Clapton's take on it then. Talking again about John Mayall. I wasn't sure about the way he sang or the way he presented himself, but I was very grateful that someone saw my worth. And my thinking was that maybe I would be able to steer the band toward Chicago blues instead of the sort of jazz blues that the band was currently playing. He seemed happy to go along with this. I think that until I came along, he had been quite isolated in his musical tastes, and now he'd found someone just as serious about the blues as he was. I joined the Blues Breakers in April 1965 and went to live with John in his house in Lee Green, which he shared with his wife Pamela and their children. 12 years older than me, with long curly hair and a beard, which gave him a look not unlike Jesus, he had the air of a favorite schoolmaster who still manages to be cool. He didn't drink and was a health food fanatic, the first proper vegetarian I had ever met. Trained as a graphic artist, John made a good living as an illustrator of things like science fiction books, and he worked as well for advertising agencies, but his real passion was music. He played piano, organ, and rhythm guitar, and he had the most incredible collection of records I had ever seen, with rare singles of songs you otherwise find only on compilation albums. Many of these were ordered through Blues Unlimited, a special magazine run by blues fan Mike Ledbetter. I had a tiny little cupboard room at the top of John's house, barely big enough for a narrow single bed, and over the better part of a year, when I had any spare time, I would sit in this room listening to records and playing along with them, honing my craft. That's how we spent 1965. Modern Chicago blues became my new mecca. It was a tough electric sound, spearheaded by people like Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, and John Lee Hooker, who had come up from the Delta to record for labels like Chess. The leading guitar players of this genre were Otis Rush, Buddy Guy, Elmore James, Hubert Sumlin, and Earl Hooker, to name
a
few.
The greats.
Right. It perfectly suited our lineup of guitar, bass, drums, and keyboard. John played piano, Hammond organ, and rhythm guitar. On drums, we had Huey Flint, who would go on to form a band with Tom McGinnis called McGinnis Flint. I played lead guitar, and the bass player was John McVie, who later formed Fleetwood Mac with Mick Fleetwood.
He did.
Not only was he a brilliant bass guitarist, but he was an incredibly funny man with a very dark, cynical sense of humor. The album that came out was called Blues Breakers with Eric Clapton. Let's hear, as we mentioned, Eric Clapton was idolizing Freddie King, one of those guitarists. Here's Eric Clapton doing his take on a song that Freddie King had made famous a number of years earlier. Here's Hideaway. Thank you. Whoa.
And so goes the blues jam.
Well, there you hear it. I mean, all that woodshedding obviously really did him some of me. Because now you're talking, he's fully formed now. He's no longer just playing with the form. Now, all of a sudden, after sitting up in John's attic and playing wrong with the records and practicing and practicing and practicing, he's got it now. Basically, he's achieving his ideal rather completely here.
His practice paid off.
Remind you, you're listening to How Music Changed, or the American Hit Radio version, Friday version of American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM. Heidi and I do this every Wednesday and Friday from 5 until 6. Mm-hmm. If you're interested in the series, and we've done a bunch of these, by the way, by now, there's about 30 or 40 of these that are under our belt. We post all of these shows live on our, well, they're on our website for instant listening whenever you want to check it out. Go to search for American Hit Radio. Our homepage will pop right up. Look for AmericanHitNetwork.com. And you'll see our Wednesday show on the left side. The Friday show is on the right side. The Friday show would be this show, the How Music Changed series. If you wanted to hear part one of Eric Clapton, that will be up there. And then part two follows shortly after that. Our previous series where we did a whole 40-some-odd shows on the Rolling Stones is there. We did a whole series on the Beatles. That's there. You could hear that entire history. We did a show basically on the birth of the blues. Otis Redding, James Brown, the Beach Boys. Just to name a few, they're all there on the website. So if you want to check it out, if you got some time to spare and you want to hear some great music and a little bit of history.
That's just, right. Get your study on.
That's right. Hundreds of hours of it. Well, since we're on the album Blues Breakers with Eric Clapton, let's play another track from the same album. This one is called All Your Love.
Never knew what I was missing. All your love, pretty baby, that I got in store for you. All your love, pretty baby, that I got in store for you. Say you love me too.
then, picking up with Eric Clapton's Take Care. At this point, people began to talk about me as if I were some kind of genius, and I heard that someone had written the slogan, Clapton is God, on the wall of Islington Underground Station. Then it started to spring up all over London like graffiti. I was a bit mystified by this, and part of me ran a mile from it. I didn't really want that kind of notoriety. I knew it would bring some kind of trouble. Another part of me really liked the idea that what I had been fostering all these years was finally getting some recognition. The fact is, of course, that through my playing, people were being exposed to a kind of music that was new to them, and I was getting all the credit for it, as if I had invented the blues. As for technique, tons of white American guitar players were better than me. Apart from the famous blues guys, there were a lot of white players, too. Reggie Young, for example, a Memphis session player, is one of the best guitarists I had ever heard. I had seen him playing with the Bill Black combo on the Ronettes package tour. Don Peake, who I saw play with the Everly Brothers, and James Burton, who played on Ricky Nelson's records, were two others. English guitarists I had seen who had knocked me out were Bernie Watson and Albert Lee. They both played with Screaming Lord Such's band, The Savages. Bernie and Such's pianist Andy Wren were supreme musicians, far ahead of everyone else at that time. I remember hearing them play Worried Life Blues, the Big Maceo song, and Bernie was bending notes, which he had been doing long before anybody. Though I rated Jeff Beck and also Jimmy Page, their roots were in rockabilly while mine were in the blues. I loved what they did. There was no competitiveness between us. We just played different styles. But another part of me thought the Clapton of God thing was really quite nice. I'd been ousted from the Yardbirds, and they'd brought in Jeff Beck. They immediately had a string of hits, and I was quite put out by that. So any kind of accolade that came from just playing without selling myself or promoting myself on TV was welcome. There's something about word of mouth that you cannot undo. In truth, I felt grateful about it because it gave me status, and even better, it was the kind of status nobody could tamper with. After all, you can't muck around with graffiti. It comes from the street. Blues Breakers, John Mayall with Eric Clapton, was the breakthrough album that really brought my playing to people's attention. It was made at a time when I really felt I'd found my niche in a band where I could remain in the background yet at the same time develop my skills, driving the band in the direction I thought it ought to go. We went into the Decca Studios in West Hampstead for 3 days in April and played exactly the set we did on stage, with the addition of a horn section on some of the tracks. The songs included Parchment Farm, a Mose Allison number, on which John performed a harmonica solo, the Ray Charles song What Did I Say, featuring a drum solo by Huey Flint, and Ramblin' on My Mind by Robert Johnson, on which John insisted that I do the vocals. This was much against my better judgment, since most of the guys I longed to emulate were older and had deep voices, and I felt extremely uncomfortable singing in my high-pitched whine. Here's that track. Here's Eric Clapton singing Ramblin' on My Mind.
Thank you. got neat things. I got neat things all on my mind. Little girl, little girl. I got neat things all on my mind. Is to leave my baby. She treat me so unkind.
Robert Johnson's song called Ramblin' on My Mind. First mm-hmm. vocal of Eric Clapton on record right there on that track. Always like the willing to basically take off and follow his own whim. Right in the middle of all this, he decided to actually like leave England for a while. He put together another band with friends. They called themselves the Glands, and nice. They just like toured around Europe. Never really did anything as far as recording or anything. But basically spent themselves driving around trying to find gigs, pick up gigs, anything. It was kind of like basically playing it as low key as possible. After driving through like places like Yugoslavia and Greece and such, he eventually comes back. And again, we'll pick up with Eric Clapton telling the story. Returning to England in late October, I found that my place in the Blues Breakers had been filled by a brilliant guitarist, Peter Green, later of Fleetwood Mac, who had aggressively pestered John to employ him, often turning up at gigs and shouting from the audience that he was much better than whoever was playing that night. Though I barely knew him, I got the impression that here was a real Turk, a strong, confident musician who knew exactly what he wanted and where he was going, but who played his cards close to his chest. Most important, he was a phenomenal player with a great tone. He was not happy to see me coming back, as it meant a rather sudden end to what had obviously been a good gig for him. One change that didn't particularly surprise me was that John McVie had finally been given the boot and had been replaced by Jack Bruce, the bass player from the Graham Bond organization, whom I had seen play at the Marquee. Jack stayed for just a few weeks before moving on to join Manfred Mann, during which time we toured the club circuit in the south of England. But doing those few gigs, we had a chance to take stock of one another. Musically, he was the most forceful bass player I had ever played with. He approached the gig almost as if the bass were a lead instrument, but not to the point where it got in the way, and his understanding of time was phenomenal. All this was reflected in his personality, fiery and quick-witted. I'm glad to say it seemed like a mutual admiration and we fit together brilliantly, a taste of things to come, which is exactly what we're going to pick up next week. But there is a recording of John Mayall's Blues Breakers on that tour, that short-lived tour, where Jack Bruce is playing bass, and here is a recording from the Flamingo Club in April 1966, featuring Jack Bruce on bass with Eric Clapton and John Mayall performing Have You Ever Loved a Woman? See you next week, everybody. Thank you.
trouble and pain.
Thank you very much indeed. Eric Clapton there on guitar.